Hello everyone and welcome to this online session, How to Comply with the FCA's Safeguarding Requirements. My name is Niamh McConaghy and I'm the Marketing Executive at FSCom, and I'm delighted to introduce FSCom's Director Alison Donnelly and Associate Director Heather O'Gorman. So before I pass you over to Alison, I just need to make you aware of some housekeeping. So the audience is on mute and you will only be able to hear Alison, Heather and myself throughout the session. If you have any questions, please post them into the question box on the side panel and we will try and get through as many as we can in the Q&A session at the end. Any questions not answered will be followed up by email next week. Finally, we also have get asked if this session is recorded, and yes it is. You will receive the recording in a follow-up email and it will be available on the FSCom website in the next few days. So that's everything from me, and I'm going to pass it over to Alison.
Thank you, Niamh, and thank you everybody who's joined us. We have had a great deal of number of people signing up for this webinar, so we're delighted that we've got a topic that's so close to everybody's heart, certainly been very close to mine for a good few years, and I know it has equally for Heather. And the other really great thing is that you've given us brilliant questions already. So Heather and I are going to be asking each other the questions that you've posed to us, and then we'll turn at the end to the questions that you pose during the session. So first, let me introduce myself. I am Alison Donnelly. I'm a payments regulation specialist and a director at FSCom. Hopefully you already know about FSCom, but we're a governance, risk and compliance consultancy. Our side of the house specialise in payment services and e-money. We've been in this sector for over 10 years, and I joined FSCom 10 years ago from the FCA, where I was the e-money policy specialist. I am absolutely delighted to be joined by a friend and fellow payments regulation specialist, Heather O'Gorman, who I've known for many years. Probably you have too, but I'll ask her to introduce herself now. Heather.
Thank you very much, Alison. Absolutely. So I'm an associate director here at FSCom. As Alison mentioned, we've known each other for quite a while in this space and attended many a FCA debate and been involved in many a consultation together. So it's a lovely opportunity to be able to work not only with yourself, Alison, but also with the rest of the specialist payment services team here. My background is in compliance consultancy, specialising in the payment services space. I have a range of specialisms from open banking to EMIs, your regular money remitters and your FX brokers. And generally speaking, I've worked to support firms through their requirements with consumer duty, most recently, quite fundamentally, financial crime, and ultimately what we're all here to talk about today, which is safeguarding requirements as well.
Thanks, Heather. Well, look, let's get started. This wasn't a question, but I think it's a good question. Nonetheless, let's talk about the very basics of safeguarding. Heather, would you run us through that, please?
Absolutely, more than happy to. So, as you say, Alison, great point, starting point, I think, for the conversation ahead, just to give us the lay of the land, looking at some of the basics of safeguarding. So firstly is the legislation. So ultimately, what is it that makes firms have to safeguard? So where are you going to find that information? Is in the Payment Service Regulations 2017. It is very brief on this matter. It's not in a great deal of detail, for sure, but it certainly is the fundamentals. It is what the requirements are to be legally compliant with your safeguarding controls. From there, the FCA have built out some guidance around how firms should implement their safeguarding frameworks. The guidance is the approach document, which is specifically made for payment services and e-money firms, completely separate to those regulated under the Financial Service and Marketing Act, for example. So it's very specific to the approach that payments and e-money firms should take to their regulatory controls, and includes a whole chapter on safeguarding. Now, it's got quite a lot of information provided within there. However, I think we can both agree that certain elements of it are still a little bit grey on the exact definitions and approach that the FCA is looking for it to take. Also, I think there is an element of this approach document has gone through some versions recently as well, and had some additional elements added to it, and it has changed in throughout its history, but maybe not fundamentally enough. I don't think, in my opinion, it's probably kept quite up to date enough with some of the changes in the models that we're seeing, especially in the fintech world, the money space, and the new ways that payment services are being used. So ultimately, and I think we're going to be talking in more detail in a bit anyway about what we're hoping maybe that guidance can lead us to understand in the future, and how that might be adapted and changed. But ultimately, what that guidance document is looking to provide firms with is, when does safeguarding start? When does safeguarding end? How do you ensure that you're safeguarding your firm's funds correctly? And doing reconciliation, understanding what discrepancies are and breaches. So there's sort of some really good information in there that firms should be addressing and should be very familiar with if you're listening in on the call anyway, I'd like to hope. So the two methods in which a firm can choose to safeguard, which again is outlined in legislation and then detailed within the guidance, is one of two options. So you've got the segregation method. This is one that fundamentally every payment service firm has to undertake or has undertaken at some point in its life cycle, which is this concept of ensuring that you recognise your funds versus your customers' funds, being able to identify where they are your customers' funds, and ensuring that they are safely secured within your framework, whether that be in a safeguarded bank account or via some low-risk secure liquid assets. The other option, and something that we're going to explore in more detail throughout this conversation because it's come up in questions, unsurprisingly, is the concept of the bond guarantee or the insurance product. Well, how we see this used generally is in conjunction with the segregation method, and it's often used to cover specific safeguarding risks, but ultimately, it's still quite new to market, and I think there's still a lot to be spoken about, and certainly something we're going to cover in considerably more detail as we go through this conversation, I think. So moving on from there, I think what will be really helpful to understand from yourself, Alison, is maybe some of the areas that you have found recently, especially that our firms are finding problematic with the safeguarding framework.
Of course. Well, you said it yourself, the legislation is actually very brief and the detail of the FCA's approach is in the approach document. The main difficulty with safeguarding provisions is that they're all contained in the statutory regulations, but they have to bump up and intersect with insolvency legislation. And the only way we'll ever really know if the legislation does its job well and properly is if we have court cases where a judge determines what happens to those funds. Now, for many years there were no court cases, but in fact over the last couple of years there have been a few, and what we find from that is, so far, good news, the judges are really very customer friendly, and even where there's been funds deficits or something wrong with the safeguarding process, they have generally sought to get as much funds back to the customers as possible, because the risk has always been that if there are funds in the account that shouldn't be, that creditors would say, those funds belong to us, we should be able to have access to them, and that would then pollute the safeguarding protection and mean that customers wouldn't get as much funds back as they otherwise could or should have. So yes, we've now had court cases, but no court case has yet gone to the highest court in the land, so actually that's not even definite yet. So the second problem is that the court cases show how expensive it is for the funds to be returned to the customers, and the longer and more complicated that process is, then the less money there will be to be returned. So where this leaves the FCA is that they've had to take a very exacting approach. Some might call it pedantic, but it's very exacting. It's about being absolutely precise with the funds. And what bamboozles clients an awful lot is whenever we make the point that over-safeguarding, as counterintuitive as it is, over-safeguarding is as bad as under-safeguarding, because the expectation is that we have the precise amount in the accounts. And of course, when we think of one fund flow coming through, a small value coming through for a customer, the transaction going through the various accounts and out to the beneficiary, that's an easy enough process to follow. But what payment and e-money institutions are having is countless amounts of money coming in all the time, countless amounts of money going out all the time, and having to balance the requirements to the exactness of the FCA's greatest expectations. And so I'd like now to turn to a very good question that has come in from an attendee, which is what is the common mistakes that fintechs or new payment firms make in relation to safeguarding? I can certainly think of one, Heather, but I'll let you go first.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, when this question came in, we had quite a good conversation around quite a few areas that we could choose from, but realised we could probably do a whole webinar on just that alone. So I think we've picked one each, which makes much more sense. So ultimately, yeah, I think the area I'm going to focus on for this particular question is the idea that firms believe safeguarding only begins at the end of the business day following receipt of the funds. And I can completely understand where this confusion comes from, because this wording is included within the guidance. So ultimately, what that wording is saying is that by the end of the following business day that you've received the funds, you should have those funds in your designated safeguarding bank account. What it's not saying is that that's when your safeguarding starts. Your actual obligation to start safeguarding is upon receipt of relevant funds. So where this confusion can sometimes come from is that actually, what we see with a typical probably safeguarding model, not all but most, will have a version of will have an initial segregation account, or will have an initial segregation process in place to ensure that the funds that they're receiving from their customers can be identified as either the users or their own. And if it is their own, because that's maybe a fee that's been charged on the customer and that's been received as part of the payment, that can be isolated, identified, removed from the pool before the funds are then being provided into the user safeguarded bank account. What that ultimately means is that it gives a bit of operational buffer for the firm to be able to get those funds accurately in the safeguarded bank account. And I think one of the really good examples of why this is necessary is when we look at the agent model and the whole concept that an agent can undertake payment services on your behalf. But what an agent isn't going to have is a safeguarded bank account. That's you. That's your responsibility as the firm to have that account. So if I were to go into a convenience store and use a Western Union, a MoneyGram, anyone along those lines, or even in the more fintech related agent model, think about the fact that you've got to give those, your funds are being given to someone who isn't going to be able to safeguard them straight away, but they can segregate them. And that's the difference. That's the important differentiation here, is the idea that we don't commingle, and that if you were to give your £10 note to pay off your payee in a different country in your convenience store, that agent has the responsibility to put that £10 in a separate safe to his own. That's as sort of basic as that concept gets, but obviously that the same applies when we're talking about the fintech world as well. But that's ultimately why there is this difference between segregation and that element to segregate to begin with versus the actual safeguarding account and what needs to be in there. Alison, over to you. What was the point that you wanted to cover on this one?
So you started with the beginning of the process. I'd like to look at the end of the process, and that is sort of comes up in two different ways. Moving funds out of the safeguarding account. Some firms have other providers who move the funds for them because it's more cost efficient, or perhaps even the only route to move the funds from one from the safeguarding account to another provider to get them to the end beneficiary. Unfortunately, that breaks the safeguarding protection. And if you're using another party to get the funds there, you can't do that. Or if you do that, you need to cover the value in the safeguarding protection another way, whether that's by using the insurance method or holding other funds in the account to make up for it. So that's one thing that's been really problematical to firms. The other aspect is we're very well aware of firms who have had to move the funds out of their safeguarding account in order to because their bank won't allow the funds to be made, the payments to be made from the safeguarded account. And it's actually the way the Lithuanian regulator looks at it. they won't allow the funds to come out of the safeguarding account. So you have to move the funds into another account and send it again. But again, the safeguarding protection is broken, and there's no other reason that funds should be removed from the safeguarding account once they're in there, other than to get them on the last leg of the journey to the end beneficiary, which is expensive. Basically, that's very expensive for the payment or e-money institution, because it'll inevitably mean you have to have some form of duplication of those funds. And there was actually another question that came in that sort of relates to this topic of the problems, so and the common difficulties, and that is, we've been asked to explain the difference in safeguarding for related and unrelated payment services. Heather, I think we both have found ourselves explaining related and unrelated payments a lot, so I'll just cover that one now. So this is only relevant to e-money institutions. E-money institutions issue e-money, of course, that's the pot of funds. But as the definition itself says, e-money is for the purpose of making payments. So the funds have to be able to be used for making payments. And so those payments, where they're connected to the e-money, are called related payment services. So e-money and related payment services. On the other hand, a firm might, an e-money institution might want to offer other types of payment service activities disconnected from the e-money. So for instance, we have a lot of e-money institution clients that also do acquiring services, and indeed there are some that will also do a money remittance service, and those are operated as a distinct from the e-money, so it's not the same, you know, it's not the same customer with the e-money contract, it's another contract. And guess what? They're called the unrelated payment services. And it's almost like mashing together an e-money institution and a payment institution. And that's because there's two sets of capital requirements. There's one for the e-money, and then the top on top of that is the one for as if they were a payment institution. And very importantly for the topic of the day, safeguarding has to be done separately. That means separate bank accounts, separate reconciliation processes. They could be done at the same time and side by side, and probably quite possibly done by the same team, but they have to be separate and kept distinguished like that. Okay, next question. What are the reconciliation obligations with respect to safeguarded assets and segregated accounts?
Okay, so I think this is a really important question, and I think reconciliation is certainly something that is a really important topic, because we tend to see so many different methods of reconciliation, whether it be quite manual, whether it be automated, whether it be an off-the-shelf solution. There are so many elements that can that pull into reconciliation. I still think there's a lot of opportunity for development in this space and for people's understanding and improvement. So I think it's a really important question ultimately, and in ensuring this is the pinnacle point of ensuring that you're holding the right amount of funds for your customers. So it has to be right and it has to be well thought through. But I think first off, what I'm going to do is distinguish the difference between segregation and reconciliation. So I have spoken to segregation a little bit already, ultimately about this concept of your funds should be identified as your own and your user funds should be identified as theirs. So the concept of segregation being that the funds come into a bank account where you then constantly throughout the day are identifying they're my funds because they're fees that are owed to me, or they're my customers' funds, they're funds that are going to be used for a payment service. Do I need to safeguard them? Are they going straight out? That's the kind of analysis that should be going on in your segregation account. It needs to be ensuring that ultimately we are reducing any risk of commingling. So there is an element of commingling in the segregation account. It's unavoidable. The funds go in. They've probably got fees involved. Let's remove the fees as soon as physically possible to ensure we're reducing that commingling risk. Ensuring, as the FCA guidance says, that you're definitely not commingling overnight. But obviously, as frequently as possible throughout the day, we want the movement of those funds in and out of that SEG account, ensuring that the customer's funds are being safeguarded as soon as possible. The difference there with when we're talking about a reconciliation, now what we're doing, so the segregation is all day, right? We're expecting funds to be flying around your bank accounts constantly. You're not just sitting on customers' funds waiting till the end of the day to send out all their payments. Everyone's constantly in and out, as you said, Alison, earlier. It's influx in, influx out of payments all day out of those accounts. But with the reconciliation process, what that should be is a moment in time for you to be able to distinguish, are you holding the right amount of funds for your customer? And that reconciliation process is broken down into two parts. So we've got an internal rec and an external. I'll start off with the internal reconciliation. And this is the concept that all of those funds that have been flying in and, all that, in and out all day, all of that data that you've collected about those funds coming in and out, can you analyze those and compare those to the data that you now have on your ledger that says, and this is how much money we should be holding for our customers? So utilizing the information, whether it be from your settlement providers, whether it be from your banks, whether it be from third party systems or your own systems, to ensure that you have interrogated the information that you're about to use to identify how much you should be holding for your customers. So not just taking it on the word of my ledger says I should be holding X, Y, and Z amount for each customer. You've actually done some form of internal verification that that data is accurate and correct. So that's step one. Next point is the external reconciliation. So now you're very comfortable that the data you've got is accurate. You've compared it against the data that you have available to you. So now we need to ensure that the bank now replicates how much you think you should have. So this is often something where firms will find a discrepancy between the amount that is in the bank versus the amount that the data says should be in the bank. And that isn't instantly a problem. Ultimately, we kind of expect, especially with timing issues, especially with the complexity of payments going in and out of the SEG account into the safeguarding account, that there will be differences. So the most important thing is that firms can make up that difference or remove the difference if there's over safeguarding within those accounts. What that isn't to say is that there's suddenly a massive breach. You have, you know, I think some firms get a little bit scared about the word discrepancy, thinking that we're talking about there being a material breach in their systems. But no, that discrepancy just needs to be rectified, needs to be rectified by the end of the day. And if it can't for any material reason, then we start talking about whether it's a breach or not. But ultimately, the initial difference between the rec and the bank account is almost expected. So that's ultimately where I'd come to on reconciliation and how reconciliation is done, especially that external piece. We find it's really different across so many different payment service providers. We've seen some really whizzy third party systems that can help with the reconciliation process. I've seen some not so whizzy third party reconciliation systems as part of the audit process. I think fundamentally, though, if we're being realistic, most payment firms are probably still using a spreadsheet for this, if I'm not mistaken. I've seen quite a lot of them. And not to say that that's wrong, and you certainly are still being compliant, but it does come with its own risks, and it does create this sort of manual concept where you have to pick a time of day where there is an employee in your business able to run that reconciliation for you. So it's about understanding whether your risk of commingling or your risk of not being able to identify user funds from your own is large enough for you to consider whether you need something a bit more automated, something that can actually speak to the bank, speak to your ledger system, and do that reconciliation process for you in the background without that manual intervention. Anyway, so I've gone on and on about the safeguarding process and the reconciliation process very much from an operational first line point of view. So this is how you should be doing it. But I think what's really important is the other side of that is the compliance side, the monitoring piece. How would you say, Alison, is sort of really effective compliance oversight of the safeguarding framework?
Thanks, Heather. Yeah, look, we have audited over 100 firms for safeguarding, and one of the things that we really like to see and don't often see is a really good division between the first and second line responsibilities. So I think that's a good starting point, and that allows that the first line take responsibility obviously at the operational side, and they do their own quality assurance and make sure their processes are right, but the second line have an overseeing duty, and they check that things are being done, sample testing and the likes. So I think that's really useful. A great starting point is when we can see that a firm has clearly mapped out the rules and how those rules are interpreted to their own business model, and they have mapped out the risks. They've understood or they've noted down how they control those risks, and they have assessed the effectiveness of their controls. When we see that, we know that they've really put time and effort into being able to pull it through, and that makes our audit much easier. And it makes it much easier for the second line to be able to monitor, because then they can understand where the risk areas are, so their monitoring plan can be proportionate. Sometimes we see that there isn't sufficient quality assurance and overview of outsourcing service providers, and this is often in the case where a payment or e-money institution is part of a group and another part of the group undertakes the operations, the first line responsibility, which, look, on the face of it is fine, can be done of course, but we need to see that the UK entity has somebody who takes first line responsibility for those processes and oversees on a day-to-day basis that the segregation and the reconciliation are happening properly. Another area is about risk assessing of the safeguarding partners, and making sure that they understand who they're safeguarding with and what risks are inherent with using that those partners, and indeed even the process of how they've chosen, the method of how they've chosen to safeguard. Another area that we quite often see gaps is where and when and how a firm will escalate issues internally. You've spoken to that already, Heather, escalating internally and then escalating to the FCA, understanding what areas should be escalated to the FCA is a big question, and actually one that somebody has raised. So Heather, I'm going to ask you, on reporting breaches, if a firm has breached the safeguarding regulations and it's been discovered in an audit, what is the next course of action?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really important question, and absolutely being able to self-identify as well as identify issues during audit are both really important. I'm going to speak to those breaches identified that may be part of an audit process, but I think it very similarly applies when we're looking at self-identified concerns as well. But ultimately, look, I think starting point is, if there's anyone on the call about to go into their first safeguarding audit, expect findings, right? And anyone who has had their first audit, I'm really hoping you've had some findings ultimately, because what we would certainly expect is that this is a very complex, very grey area in some regards as to how you actually apply safeguarding rules. And I think you spoke to it very neatly there before, Alison, when you were talking about that element of risk. I think what we don't see enough is firms just sort of saying, all right, well, if we just make sure we're safeguarding enough that my reconciliation works, then we're fine. But actually, every single business model, every single audit I've ever done, every single flow of funds is different. Never are they the same. Everyone does it ever so slightly differently, different banks, different providers, different ins and outs, different customer types. And each one of those elements comes with a different risk, ultimately. So what the auditor really needs to come in is truly understand exactly what it is that you are trying to achieve personally in your own flow of funds process and identify where there's potential risks. And you're going to have some, because chances are you haven't been able to identify every single issue. And as you say, Alison, hundreds of audits between us, no doubt, and sort of help firms to build their safeguarding processes, etc. And we've seen a lot, maybe not everything. I mean, we still get the odd surprise going into the odd audit, but generally speaking, I think we've seen a lot of different ways that firms set up their safeguarding arrangements, and we can certainly speak to where we see the biggest risk. And ultimately, what we'll always do, or what I think firms should certainly expect, is that they'll have different levels of finding. There's not going to be, just because we've had a finding, it's material, it's high risk. It might be a lower risk finding to do with maybe your policies and procedures could do with a bit of a touch up here or there, or maybe there's a something that's not quite compliant, but you've done as much as you can to mitigate the risk, and you've shown us that you've evidenced that you've put as best control as you can to mitigate that risk ultimately. And I think the important thing as well to think about is that we'd expect these findings year on year on year as well. This isn't something that you'd probably find just your first audit. What we'd also want to see is that first audit takes place. You take those findings, you rectify them to the best of your ability. And then when we come in for the next year's audit, you've gone and changed all your processing systems, or half your employees have all changed, or you've grown exponentially and all of a sudden your values and volumes of payments have gone through the roof. And that changes everything, right? And it changes the risk profile and it changes the likely results from the audit. So again, don't expect a one-stop shop audit approach. You're not going to have one audit fix everything and it's going to be unbreakable for future. There always should be findings, always better ways to improve as the market grows and things progress. But ultimately, what is material? And I think this is a really good question. And ultimately, when we're taking the view and we're reviewing someone's framework, this isn't about a proportion or a value of customer funds that would equal a material breach. Frankly, if you've over safeguarded or under safeguarded by 2p, what's the difference between 2p and 2 million? Ultimately, it's still an issue potentially. I think what we're more looking at is whether it's systematic. Was that 2p difference or was that 2 million difference because of a systematic issue that has, we can find evidence, has been a concern for days, weeks, months, however it might be, or that you have an actual fundamental issue with your systems and processes, rather than as we were speaking about earlier, it being a discrepancy and it being, I fixed that 2p, we found out what the issue was, it's been fixed, we've put it on our risk register, we've put controls in place, all of our policies and procedures have been put up to date, and we are now compliant again. That would be a very different finding for us than ultimately something that is materially a concern. So, in your last question, Alison, you mentioned and touched on due diligence for banks. And I think this is really interesting, especially with SVB recently. It's become quite obvious that maybe the banking infrastructure isn't as robust as we'd absolutely love it to be. And I think going into the crisis that we are and the cost of living, and 08 did happen, you know, that we're not apps. We can't say that the banking infrastructure is 100%. So given some of those considerations, what should firms be doing to ensure that initially and on an ongoing basis, they're doing thorough enough due diligence on their credit institution partners?
Thanks, Heather. And just as you're saying that, that's a question that came in beforehand. We are getting loads of really great questions. You'll have seen me looking this way. We're getting loads of really great questions from you, which we will tackle. But first to this question that you've asked. First of all, the FCA expects that an assessment has to be taken at least annually. And then I totally understand this. This is often met with some annoyance by payment and e-money institutions because they feel that they don't have much choice about who is going to be their safeguarding providers. So it's not like they can compare and find it wanting and go elsewhere. So choice has been limited. I totally recognise that. But the FCA's approach is that it should be at least annually and any time that situations change that would merit a check. Now, I don't know if anybody had a great crystal ball and were able to see what was coming down the line with SVB, and maybe they were able to do an assessment prior to that. I'm not sure that that's going to have been a case, and whether anybody was able to get their funds out immediately before. I think there were some firms that did do that. Brilliant. But that's the kind of situation that you should prompt a review. There's some criteria suggested in the approach document about what to assess, but I think the most important points to consider are obviously the credit rating of the bank and how that changes, and promptly that changes is of course another issue. But another one to consider is the location of the bank. And what's interesting about this is that following Brexit, the UK legislation has been changed such that UK payment and e-money institutions can safeguard in any UK bank, in any EEA bank, and indeed any OECD bank, and indeed in any bank in a jurisdiction equivalent to OECD. So actually the net's quite broad. In practice, we haven't found that really impacting our clients much because lack of familiarity with safeguarding requirements in those OECD and beyond institutions, it just hasn't materialized into very much. But what we know from the Wirecard situation was that the FCA was so worried about that situation and where the funds were outside of the UK, they called a halt for that weekend, and they required that the money be brought back from outside of the UK into a UK credit institution. And that tells us something about their concern where funds are not in the UK and their ability to make sure that, the money is ring-fenced and continues to be ring-fenced. Take all of that what you will. I think it's an important consideration. When we go into audit firms, what we're looking for is that they have done the risk assessment on the safeguarding partners, and indeed the assessment of the method of safeguarding, that they've understood the risk, they've considered if there is any way to lower the risk, and recognising that in many cases there simply won't be, but that where in terms of partner, and then that they have actively accepted the risk, the residual risk, once any mitigations have been put in place. So to the next question, look, we have two questions that are quite similar, so we'll take them together. One is, does the FCA accept alternative safeguarding arrangements such as the insurance policy guarantee or low risk investments? And the other is, how can an UK EMI manage the safeguarding customers' funds to ensure these are protected by the FSCS as per the Bank of England update in March 23? Heather, let's split this between us and you talk about the insurance and I'll take secure low risk liquid assets. You go first.
Fantastic. No, happy to do so. I think the insurance option is really interesting, and I think it's certainly something that we're starting to see grow, and I think there's a bit more of an appetite here, not only from a broker and insurer point of view to offer this particular insurance, but for firms to try and understand better about what it could maybe do for them. What I don't think it is a golden ticket to say, oh yeah, this just fixes all of our safeguarding, we never have to worry about it again because we've got insurance. That's probably not quite as far as we'd be able to go with what this actually means. But what it certainly does do is allows you to mitigate certain risks that are associated with your safeguarding framework. So just going back to actually what is the insurance product? So it is quite limited, the amount of people that are actually providing this product. Those that are offering the bond, we have seen that it's been accepted by the FCA, not approved, certainly wouldn't use the wording, but it has been accepted by the FCA as part of their review process of the safeguarding framework. But it's obviously very important that firms still review exactly what the cover entails and understand exactly what the policy wording means, and actually when that policy pays out and how it pays out would be really important. And coming back to that, how it pays out, I've had this conversation many a startup firm who say to me, can't I just get the insurance product? Because then I don't have to get a safeguarded bank account. I don't have to do all that worry about finding a safeguarding provider, which I completely appreciate and understand where that sentiment comes from. However, you still need a safeguarded bank account, even if you have the insurance product. And the main reason for that being, if the insurance does need to pay out, it needs to pay out into a safeguarded bank account. So regardless, and that's why, to be honest, we probably see the safeguarding insurance product being used more by more established firms where they are starting to realize that there are certain specific risks that they want to mitigate using the insurance product rather than using it in isolation. So most firms will have a element of segregation and insurance at the same time, and they might use the insurance product for, say, covering up to a certain amount of their customer funds, so they have a little bit more liquidity to play with. Or it might be that they have a specific risk, like as something you've mentioned earlier, Alison, using third party payout partners, don't have to double up on their safeguarding liquidity requirements, covering that with the insurance product, for example. So I think there's definitely some real interesting scope for making the insurance product a bit more mainstream and having more people utilize it. It's just about how it's used and how it's best used in practice with every different firm's flow of funds and ultimately different risks.
Brilliant. The other option is to invest in low risk secure liquid assets, still part of the segregation method. And we're seeing this bubbling up to the top more as well, because perhaps a reflection on the change in the interest rates, but also we know that some banks are actively encouraging their payment and e-money institution clients to take the funds off their balance sheet, and this is one way of doing it. So there is a greater risk Is there a greater risk? There is a greater risk in the funds than in a deposit, because like any investment, there are risks. But of course, this, you're only allowed to use very low risk, secure, liquid assets. So that should minimize it to a certain extent, but your firm needs to accept that if there is a shortfall in the value, you as a firm are going to have to make that up. So you need to be able to provide that, have those own funds to fill that gap if one arises. The other risk to consider is in respect of the security of the institution. As the questioner pointed out, in March this year, the legislation was changed so that FSCS cover is now available to the underlying eligible customers of payment and e-money institutions if the safeguarding bank goes bust. Now, we have to be absolutely clear, this is not FSCS cover for the payment or e-money institution customers generally, nor if the, in the event that the payment or e-money institution goes bust. This is if the underlying, if the safeguarding partner, the bank, goes bust. And that's not available for those who use the authorised custodian to hold the secure low-risk liquid assets. Now, in such case, eligible claimants will be compensated, and they're hopeful that this will come through within 3 months, up to the 85,000 limit. And of course, eligible claimants means, you know, generally retail customers and maybe a few others. So it's, if you're in doing business with businesses, this is not going to be very helpful or particularly more helpful. And the reason that the government made this change is that it's hoping that the fall of a bank does not then have a roll-on, knock-on impact and affect the payment and e-money institution, because of course, in that event, the payment and e-money institution still has the obligation to move the funds for the customers. These changes have been made so recently, Heather, that they are not covered in the approach document yet. We're on version 5, we're waiting for version 6, but and actually even the section on low risk secure liquid assets is very small in comparison to the segregation method.
Yeah, 100%, no, definitely. I think it's a very good point. And I think, as you mentioned, version 6, the approach document, I feel like a drum roll in anticipation for that coming out ultimately. But I think before it does, though, we're hoping that it will go to consultation first. Is that right? And if so, what would be really helpful to understand is maybe some of the things that you think are going to be picked up in that consultation and some of your inside knowledge on what that might include.
Well, we know the FCA has been dissatisfied with probably actually the whole payment and e-money institution regime. And that's because of a decision made because of the maximum harmonisation of the directives to implement through Treasury regulations rather than through FSMA. Broken away from Europe, from the EA, so free now to make its own changes. And of course, safeguarding is top of the list of priority focus, albeit the sort of broader prudential regime is also at top of the list. So in respect to this, what we think is imminent safeguarding consultation, because they promised it over summer, albeit the weather doesn't realise it's summer, we're expecting to see that they will try to address the limitations of the legislation. We know that they very much like their own CAS rules, and so we're expecting that they're going to try and put forward a CAS-like regime, which may or may not be helpful for certain payment and e-money institutions. The difficulty, of course, is that CAS doesn't even conceive of the sort of guarantee, so they need to find out a way of bringing that in. But yes, we've had assurances, it absolutely will go to consultation. We've had assurances that they're very definitely open to hearing about the vast array of business models and the complexity for firms. We've certainly spoken to them about that. One of the things in particular, there's a number of business models that find it difficult, but one in particular is about card spend. And let me just take a few minutes to explain what I mean by that. This is for e-money institutions. So when I go to Pret and buy a £5 sandwich, I hand over my e-money card and Pret accepts that and goes through the card process. I walk out with my £5 worth of sandwich. I don't also walk out with my £5 worth of e-money because I have spent that. Some would say, me in particular would say, that e-money is spent. it's no longer therefore relevant funds and should be out of the safeguarding account. Now, some firms take that approach. Other firms say, we don't have confirmation of that e-money is spent until the settlement files come in from the card scheme. So it may not go through, or there may be chargeback. So we won't action the funds being removed from the account until we get the settlement file and the call from the card scheme. That's one approach. Another approach still, and actually it turns out this is the one favoured by the FCA, is that the e-money should not, this relevant fund should not be removed from the safeguarding account, not until it's the settlement files come in, not until it's called by the card scheme, but indeed until the card scheme has delivered the funds to the merchant acquirer, which is the payment service provider of the merchant. Now, to the point we were raising earlier, that's going to involve duplication of funds because you're going to have to hold the funds in the safeguarding account. You're also going to have to make funds available for the card scheme to lift and move to the acquirer. And that is very expensive and quite possibly would break the whole system if that is the interpretation that the FCA is going to take. And this is where we as an industry need to work together to make sure that that's very loud and clearly presented. Card schemes have been doing this for many, many years. They've got a very slick process of being able to understand their risk in terms of whether the card issuer is going to be able to provide the money to the acquirer and those risks. And I think it's that should be taken into account, that these wee payment and e-money institutions can't be guaranteeing the funds going through these banking or payment systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such an important point, and one that we've been having interesting conversations around over recently as well, Alison, is whichever one of those three are chosen comes with their own complications. It comes with its own risks and its own operational considerations for firms. So whether you take it on that the funds are no longer relevant on redemption, means that firms will need to be able to have the ability to remove those funds from the safeguarded account immediately, whatever we're calling immediate in that case. How often are you scraping funds out of the safeguarded bank account? If it's on settlement, then it'll be about ensuring that you've got the right calculation still in the safeguarded account versus the settlement on the settlement date. And then ultimately, as you mentioned on the third option, having to again have this concept of double safeguarding, even though the funds seem to be with a perfectly legitimate, very competent card scheme process. And I think, I think this is just one example of many different flows that the approach document maybe just hasn't thought through in enough detail to really be able to provide solid guidance that makes sense for everyone ultimately.
Thank you.
I'm very conscious of time, but I think we wanted to cover off this one quick question before we moved on to the Q&A in the chat. So this one came through and is ultimately looking at, as a bank providing safeguarded accounts, what are the key things we should be aware of with respect to the consultation?
Thank you. Yes. Okay. So again, the consultation is not yet published, so we'll have to wait and see what it looks like exactly. But I think banks are already primed to be very alert to safeguarding because of two things. First of all, the outcome of Premier FX, where Barclays had voluntarily to pay a large sum of money over to the customers of Premier FX when they held safeguarding funds, and the Consumer Duty. It's very clear from this that the FCA expects the bank to be active in the process of monitoring their payment and e-money institutions customers, their safeguarding processes. And I think this, and we've seen this play out, it's almost to the extent that banks have become like a supervisor of payment and e-money institutions, AML compliance. The funds have gone through banks. Banks have to take responsibility. It's in their own interest to make sure that the funds that are flowing through them are not the proceeds of crime. To the same extent, I think banks are now saying, if these funds are flowing through us, we need to also be checking that the customers of the payment and e-money institutions have the right outcomes, which is about the protection of funds. And so we've seen banks really digging in and questioning on safeguarding practices, things that have caused them to be concerned or to question, does the payment or e-money institution know what's happening here and how to do this right? Have they got the right approach? So we've been asked lots of questions like that, and I think that's going to increase over the time. Shall we move to the questions from that have been submitted through the chat? Niamh, perhaps you would join us.
We have lots of questions that came through. Probably get a few the next 10 minutes, hopefully answer them all, as many as we can. And if not, you will follow up in the email in the next few days. So first question is, could you expand on the FCA expectation with regard to choosing a safeguarding bank, risk management and diversification across safeguarding accounts, this being more relevant following the demise of CVB, for example?
I feel like this is one for you, Alison.
Yes, of course. We've covered that to a certain extent because we've talked about the risk assessment of the safeguarding partners, and we've also talked about and recognised that actually for many payment and e-money institutions, getting the safeguarding account in the first instance was a hard-fought battle, and being able to secure others is not only expensive, but in some cases just not possible. As I said, where you can diversify your risk, clearly that's the best approach. And if you're not going to be able to do that, I think auditors will expect to see that the board has had a discussion on the matter, has made intelligent challenge and taken a risk-based choice out of it and understood the potential risks here and at least have a documented discussion on it.
Perfect, thank you. Okay, next question is, the FCA approach document talks about safeguarding funds in an approved foreign credit institution. Is this extensively for non-GB Great Britain funds, or can e-money institutions also safeguard Great Britain entity funds in other countries?
Yeah, ultimately, I think, as Alison spoke to earlier, and you probably speak a bit more eloquently than I can, the definition of who you use for your safeguarding banking provider is this element of foreign bank, which has its own definition. But what it doesn't state is how you then use that safeguarded provider. So as long as you've got the provisions to be able to hold those funds in sterling in that foreign bank account, there's nothing to stop you doing so, so long as you've thought about any liquidity risk involved with that or any foreign exchange risk involved in that, especially where you've got an element of FX involved in your business. But ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, nothing's stopping you doing so. The only thing that is probably worth a limitation just to think about on that is if you are using a foreign bank to provide you a sterling account, what domestic payment systems they have access to. So what actual capabilities does that bank allow you to achieve? Because if all they're going to be able to do is SWIFT payments in and out of that sterling account, you're going to have to think about the serious additional cost to you as a business, unless you're going to pass that on to your consumer duty. And if not, can they have either direct or indirect access to things like faster payments, BACs, CHAPS, etc.?
Perfect. Okay, next question is, are the FCA planning to include safeguarding funds within the FSCS protection scheme?
This is a great question because it's been discussed at such length. It's always been considered. When I was at the FCA and bringing in the second e-money directive, it was definitely considered at that point. Unfortunately, the calculation's never really been done as to whether it's cost effective and whether the cost of it would actually be prohibitive. Certainly plenty of people in the industry would very much like to have their e-money relevant funds covered by FSCS. It's the ultimate protection for customers, albeit recognising that it's only protection up to 85,000 and for certain eligible customers and the likes, but that's definitely been a demand of the sector for a long time, but it's not often met with much enthusiasm by the FCA, unfortunately.
Perfect, thank you. And then the next one is, When you would recommend a safeguarding audit, because it isn't mandatory for an FCA perspective, is it?
So everyone should get an audit because they're really important. I don't think that, again, if you're not obliged to do an audit, all e-money firms are obliged to do an audit, you must. If you are a payments firm, it depends on whether you need to undertake a statutory audit or not as to whether you should do an audit. So when you then undertake that audit, in what time frame, the FCA do recommend that you could do so in line with your accounting date. And then taking your accounting date, you could then maybe make sure that your safeguarding audit runs at about the same time as that does. But that's not an absolute obligation. If ultimately it's too much to be able to do both at the same time, you could move your safeguarding audit to a slightly different time frame.
Perfect. Thank you, Heather. I have another question for you. So on the reconciliations obligations, is it allowed to mix internal and external reconciliations? Our current process consists in uploading cash bank statements daily in our systems and reconcile our e-money ledgers records.
Heather, would you like to take that one?
Did that make sense? Do you want me to repeat the question?
Repeat the question, please. Yeah. Mastermind, repeat the question.
On the reconciliations obligations, is it allowed to mix internal and external reconciliations? Our current process consists in uploading cash bank statements daily in our systems and reconcile our e-money ledger records.
Okay, understood. Ultimately, yes. What I don't always anticipate is that the internal reconciliation is a completely separate process. Ultimately, what that internal reconciliation should be doing is informing your external reconciliation. So there is an element of that being part and parcel. I think, again, how we see firms doing internal reconciliations is vastly different depending on your system capabilities, the banks you're using, do you use API connectivity, do you do everything manually? It really does depend on your capabilities and your systems. What we want to see is that you have identified that one of your risks is that if you're only using one data source to do your internal reconciliation, that you could be at higher risk of not safeguarding the right amount. So you mitigate that risk by comparing additional data you have across the business to ensure that that number that you're going to use for your external reconciliation is accurate. How that's then undertaken really does then come down to your internal capabilities.
Thank you, Heather. I'm just mindful of time. And somebody has, it's not a question, but it's a good point, which I omitted to mention. I'll mention it now. They said that in terms of the non-UK banks, there's a concern about getting safeguarding letters. So the FCA has always recommended having acknowledgement letters over the safeguarding accounts, and that's a requirement. They went as far as putting a template letter into the approach document. UK firms are, of course, very familiar with this. It may be a little bit more difficult to get that acknowledgement letter from other non-UK banks. And I think this was in relation to the Wirecard point, that was because maybe there wasn't, I don't know, an acknowledgement that the bank had no right of set off against the funds. That was why the funds had to be brought back to the UK into an account over which there was that acknowledgement. I think that's a very important point to make. And so with that being the concluding point, I would like to thank Niamh for organising us very well, Heather for joining us and your really useful insight, and to all of you for listening and presenting such brilliant questions. There were a few that we haven't been able to get to and some were quite detailed, so we're going to come back to you on that individually. And of course, the invitation to speak to either me or Heather or any of our team directly is open to you. Niamh has posted our LinkedIn contact details, please do get in touch. We'd be very happy to speak to you, and we will send round the link to this webinar when it's posted on our website in a matter of days. Thank you again. All the best. Bye-bye.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Very much. Thank you.